Blog Talk Radio.
Looking forward to this one.
Yeah.
Well,
we have a very special guest on tonight. I saw a press release for the promoter of the winner of the main event of last week's Friday Night Fights, Leon Margulies. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's going to be coming on at 8:30 Eastern here. So we're going to have to pick his brain on why he feels his fighter won the fight. There were a couple of things that happened late in the fight and after the fight, respectively, where you might think that somebody would be justified saying Barthelemy won the fight. But as I've said in the past, if you give the judges the punch stat numbers or CompuBox numbers, I don't think they would have judged the fight the same way. And I think that needs to happen because I sent you guys the link. And it's from boxingscene.com, and so it kind of gives a little analysis in addition to the actual numbers. And it says right at the top of the page here, Usmani outlanded Barthelemy in power shots in 8 of 12 rounds. Usmani threw 264 more total punches and 241 more power shots. Usmani took Barthelemy out of his game. Barthelemy landed 25 jabs in rounds 1 and 2, and then just 24 the rest of the fight. It was a fight between two undefeated guys. Usmani had a couple more fights, I believe. He was 20-0. Barthelemy was 17-0 going in. So a lot was at stake, and it was a title shot eliminator, I think. So it's going to be tough to have an immediate rematch. I doubt that's going to happen. And it's just kind of another tragic instance of, I think, bad judging. And Tom, you sent me an article where they did some analysis of these guys and their MMA records. A couple of these judges have bad MMA records, too. So.
Yeah.
And I know you watched the play, Tom, but did you get to watch the replay, Tony?
I did not. I've been having problems with my flash player the last few weeks, so I only get to where I can't even watch it on YouTube half the time. Other than the new computer, I'm getting a little annoyed.
Yeah, mine is, I got to cross my fingers. Mine's been pretty decent the last few weeks. We haven't had as much technical difficulties as usual, but we'll have to knock on wood. We don't have any issues tonight. But this fight, I kind of had a feeling that, it was going to be a situation where, here's Bartholomew, he's at his, in his home, hometown of Miami. That's where he trains. That's where he lives. He does come from Cuba, and had a pretty interesting, both of these guys had a very interesting backstory. He basically escaped Bartholomew from Cuba, defected, and came to the United States. I think it was the same time as Guillermo Rigondeaux, I believe. So it was a pretty intense background, and I actually saw him out at the Cosmopolitan a bunch of times when I was out in Vegas. And I thought when I saw this card announced and I saw the records, I said, geez, this is a really tough test for a kid who's sort of a prospect in my eyes. And the fights that I saw him in seemed like he was put up against guys who were really overmatched. I liked his style. He was very technical, very, tight, elbows in, hands up all the time. So when I saw the first two rounds of this fight, I was shocked. Because he came out guns blazing, and if you look at the punch stat numbers, obviously the first two rounds were his best rounds. He outlanded Bartholomew 35-10 in round one, total punches, 31-15 in round two. So definitely did really well. He was being very unconventional from what I saw. He was holding his hands down a lot. He was moving better. When I saw him out in Vegas, he looked very stiff. He would throw kind of one punch at a time, but it was all, everything was behind those punches. And they were low round fights. They weren't 12 round fights. So, I don't think he was quite prepared for the length of the fight as far as output. It looked like he really spent himself in the first three rounds. And just in the middle rounds, he sort of was head down, hands up, and just bowling in. And there were a couple headbutts and opened up some cuts on Usmani. And Usmani just powered through it and just had an unbelievable comeback. I mean, right out of the movies, I thought this fight was, as far as, the underdog coming back and just turning the fight completely around. I thought he really started turning the corner in the third round. And it was really a great fight, so it was really sad to see the result. And the two things that I mentioned that were sort of weird was Usmani's corner before the last round said, you need a knockout. And that's why you saw him come out there in the 12th round and put together a heck of a performance. He didn't even throw a single jab, according to the computer box. It was just all power shots in round 12. 54 power shots landed. Out of 121, which is the highest amount that he even threw in any round. And so after that round, I said, Jesus, it's going to be impossible for them to take this away from him. But they did. So it was a disappointment, of course. And we had Steve Cunningham on just last week there. And, so it was kind of ironic to have to face this again and deal with this type of controversy again. But I'm curious, Tom, what did you think of the fight?
Well, the first two rounds, Bartholomew was doing as we would expect. He was the taller guy, and he was fighting like the taller guy, and probably the more polished guy. So it looked like he was going to be in for cruise control. But then it seemed like Usyk was able to negate that reach advantage. Did you notice how he did that? You know, his movement coming in was just awkward enough, and either Bartholomew just didn't pay attention to it, but he was just giving up the reach advantage, and it became an they were fighting on the inside. And Usmani just became, to me, I have in my notes, my favorite phrase here, but I'm saying he was becoming the boss in those middle rounds. And I liked his power, I liked his speed, and his defense. Now, Usmani's defense was not really textbook, but it was effective. And what else really matters? I mean, in the overall scheme of things, some of the...
It kind of reminded me of the way Rocky Marciano used to fight, except he wasn't quite in the crouch that Rocky
mm-hmm.
used to use. He just kind of bowled forward and clubbed him down. And just the strength of Bartholomew, it didn't really come back until the 10th round, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Even though
right.
From these punch stat numbers, that he had a good fourth round, too. He outlanded him by four total punches in the fourth. But I thought really the only big difference round for Bartholomew was the 10th. And if you notice, all three rounds, the first, second, and 10th, Bartholomew was being unconventional. He was putting his hands down. He was moving his head a lot. And he was keeping his distance. And that was very important for him to win the fight. But it was the confidence, too. It seemed like, because he couldn't knock Usmani out or make him feel the pain that I saw him put on other fighters out at the Cosmopolitan in Vegas. I mean, I saw guys just take punches from him, and they were wincing every punch. And it was that confidence that I think Bartholomew feeds off of, that he just
right.
didn't have in the rounds, because he just couldn't take Usmani out, and he just couldn't intimidate Usmani at all.
And did you notice early on, Bartholomew was doing a little taunting and the smiling, and of course, I don't know what language they were communicating.
Oh, yeah, he never did that out in Vegas. I mean,
yeah,
maybe now he might stick his tongue out or something like that, but he would never put his hands down in a fight that I noticed.
Mm-hmm.
It just very unconventional for me, seeing his
yeah, and I remember wondering, what language are they talking in? But what I noticed then is, well, first off, it didn't work. There was no intimidation factor with Usmani. I mean, the background he had, I wasn't familiar with him until I seen the introduction. But there was no intimidation factor at all. And did you notice in the 10th round, the referee didn't give a lot of time after that headbutt, and it looked like Usmani got the worst of it. But then he was the one that started taunting Bartholomew. It's like, well, okay, go ahead. I mean, you haven't hurt me with your punches. You're not going to hurt me with the headbutt. I'm still coming after you. I'm going to finish you. And he was just like almost laughing at him in the 10th round. And another fascinating thing, and all I have from my notes in the 12th round, my God. But did you notice that immediately after the decision was announced, there weren't maybe a lot of boos, but what there weren't was a lot of cheers for the guy who's that's his adopted hometown, Miami. And you'd have to think that the crowd would have been
yes,
on his side.
I meant to mention his corner telling him he needed the knockout before the 12th, and the crowd reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But you can negate the crowd reaction because Bartholomew's from Miami.
Right.
So you're not going to get too many people there who are Afghani fans.
Mm-hmm. and see, to me, that's what made the lack of cheering even driving the point home even more, that was an honest crowd there. Because, you think, okay, the hometown guy got the decision and everyone's going to be on their feet cheering it. I didn't hear a lot of that at all.
Well, the other thing, too, was Teddy Atlas had a little segment about, his New Year's resolutions. And he mentioned one thing that kind of piqued my interest. He said this relationship promoters and TV networks needs to change. It needs to be scaled down. And that really struck me because being out in Vegas, and that's where I met Teddy, and got an interview with him after a lot of back and forth, but we finally got an interview with him. And just going to those fights with Bartholomew and Margulies was always there, Leon. And they developed a really good relationship starting out with the first event, and then they had one outside, and then they brought it back inside. Cosmo, and just a perfect venue for a fight. You know, it was a little bit windy the day they did it outside. It just really did a real good job, and you know, I thought that maybe had something to do with it. Even though obviously there's probably not going to be an investigation, and we're probably not going to know anything definitively. When you have a guy who's a hometown guy, the promoter has a relationship with the network, and on top of that, you know, he's had the last two fights on that network. He's been there. He's been in front of these people before. So I thought that was kind of interesting that he mentioned that, and then it kind of came true that hey, this is a problem. Mm-hmm. But we're going to give Leon a little time later on when he calls in to defend himself and his fighter, of course. And we'll definitely want to listen to what he has to say and how he justifies it. Interestingly enough, just this morning I checked the boxing links for Google. Lo and behold, there is a ESPN article on from Brian Campbell, I believe, was the editor who wrote it. And he says, you know, let's not rush to conclusions here or jump to conclusions and rush to judgment on this as a robbery. And he said, I took Margulis' challenge and I watched it without audio and I came up with a draw. I watched it six times, he says. I came up with a draw. And I just don't know how that's possible. I mean, I saw the fight. I did the challenge. I watched it again. And the majority of the fights, I thought Barthelemy just put his head down and tried to weather the storm. And it didn't really work, obviously, because the punch stat numbers, CompuBox reveals that punches still landed. As good a defense as he showed at certain points, and as much as his money didn't really seem to hurt him until the 12th round, when he was really, I mean, that was probably the best effort he put out the whole night, Usmani, in the 12th round. And for Barthelemy to be able to keep staying standing, I think that you got to give him credit for that, a lot of credit. But I thought it was going to be so tough for anybody to take that fight away from Usmani after that round. But bottom line is, there's got to be a way for these guys to challenge these type of decisions. There's got to be a review process. There has to be some way to do it better than this.
I mean, my suggestion, and it's hard to implement because boxing's you know, been done a certain way for so long. Now, what they used to do back in the day, and if you go back, and I think, and the one fight I remember, and obviously this is the fight I watched, you know, on tape because it happened before I was born. The fights back in the day, they would just say, okay, here's the decision. Judge John Smith has it, you know, for the 15-round fight, you know, 9-6, you know, in rounds for fighter A. And the fight that I was thinking of was Frazier Ali, the first one, you know, when they fought in Madison Square Garden. Because now the fight's over. Now, it was pretty clear that Joe Frazier won the fight. The ring announcer gets it. He goes, okay, judge number one has it, say, you know, 9-6 for Frazier. Judge number two has it, you know, 8-6-1 for Frazier. So now you know Joe Frazier won this fight. So who cares what the third judge says? So I didn't like the way they announced it there. They could have said, you know, judge one, two, and three, they have it, respective rounds for your winner and still champion, Joe Frazier. But the scoring was strictly by rounds. So in the round, Frazier knocked Ali down in the 15th round. He basically still got the same amount of credit that Ali got for winning, say, the first round, when Ali was, you know, dancing and moving and using the jab. So that's when they developed the 10-point muff system, which I think came in the late 70s, early 80s. And if you go back and look at the 10-point system, you know, the winner of the round gets 10 points, the loser gets 9 or less, depending if there's a penalty or a knockdown or something like that, which is a much better way to do it because, you know, you have two guys, you know, fighting and say, you know, it's a 15-round fight and they each win, you know, well, no, let's go, it's a 12-round fight. And they each win 6 rounds. But, you know, A has scored knockdowns in 2 rounds. Well, then, theoretically, he should win by 2 points instead of it being a draw. And now here's the tricky part. You know, I don't like
they said, okay, we have these bad decisions. Should we do open scoring where all the scores get posted at the end of every round?
Well, we already tried it at WBC.
Well, they tried it, but I don't know. Here's the problem with that I see. It takes a lot of the drama out of the sport. And I said, you got two guys fighting, and it's a close fight. You know, it's a 12-round fight. It's going into the 11th and 12th round, and it's close. But the judges don't have it close. Well, now, fighter A, who could be winning, instead of thinking it could be 5-5 or, whatever the score would be after 10 rounds, 95-95, instead of him thinking, oh, shit, you know, I got to win these last two rounds, he knows he's up by 3 or 4 points, he's going to say, you know, shit, I'm just going to run and I'm going to move and I'm going to hold and I'm going to clinch and I'm going to stall and I'm going to try to survive these last two rounds. So that's a detriment or a detractor from open scoring. I think another detractor is the fact that it takes away the drama of it.
Way back in the day with the newspaper decisions, you look at Box Rec for old fighters like Harry Greb with his hundreds and hundreds of fights there. They actually had newspaper decisions where the news media actually were part of the decision in addition to the regular judges. Nowadays, the formality.
And that is so, you know, can newspapers even cover boxing anymore? How does this sound? They ought to pay me. They ought to pay me, and I'll score the fights.
Well, actually, you know, the Facebook scoring so far that they've instituted on Friday night fights until this fight got it right for every main event, I believe, since they instituted it. They got it right as far as, you know, they picked the right winner, but they didn't match the judges this time.
Right. I'm looking at, different, ideas. And I think one of the things that they did in Atlantic, I think it was Atlantic City, is when they had the Paul Williams, Eric Sarri-Londa fight a year or two ago. And Lara won the fight, you know, and Williams got the decision, or it was called a draw. I don't remember, but it was grossly unjust. Williams lost the fight. All three of those judges were suspended. I remember, and that is actually a drastic measure that I remember fights. And I'll go back to a fight back in 1999 between Evander Holyfield and Lennox Lewis, the first fight. And it was just ironic. We were going over to my dad's friend's house to watch the fight. We would always rotate and get the pay-per-views. And that night when we went over there to watch the fight, one guy came over with 5 sheets of paper. And he handed it. He's one of your guys, you know what I think will be fun tonight? If we score this fight. And we've never done this before in all, the 20 or 30 fights we've watched on pay-per-view. And we're all like, hey, sounds good to me. And we're all kind of debating with each other. And we all obviously had Lewis winning, 117-111. Then it goes to a draw. And the woman that was the major culprit was a woman by the name of Eugenia Williams. And I know she was blasted in boxing publications and magazines and on websites after that. But I don't know if she was ever suspended, and I know she still got some big fights. Now, hey, every judge can have a bad day. Every referee can have a bad day. So, I mean, you obviously got to look at their overall body of work. And when you're judging a live fight, because I've done this. I've judged. So I know what it's like. I've judged amateur fights, live arena. So it's not like I'm sitting there saying, I watched this fight on TV, and because Teddy Atlas said a guy won, I agree with him. No, I've judged amateur fights. I had my certification, and I'm going back, a couple years ago. But I know, I fought at Penn State a lot. I fought at Lock Haven. I fought out in Reno. And there's always that, very strong pro crowd for a certain fighter, a certain school. I know there were times at Lock Haven that, the crowd was so overwhelming for me that, yeah, a close fight could have swayed my way. I know a fight at Penn State. I was talking to you, Rich, before we got on the air. My fight with Jesse Bond. And the crowd, I had some members from Lock Haven that were really trying to ramp up the cheers for me. And people from Penn State were trying to drown them out. And I know it affected number one judge I was telling you about. I petitioned not to have him judge the fight because he was always very pro Penn State. And he came up to me before the fight and said, I hope you knock him out. And I'm like, well, hey, what do you mean by that? I'm just going to go out there and do my best. And I went to him, I said, yo, this guy's going to screw me tonight. And Tom, I don't know if you ever heard this one, but the guy gave the Penn State fighter every round, including the round I knocked him down in, that all he did was hold on and didn't even throw a single punch.
Yes.
Gave him that round. He came up to me the next night, and he was like, I was rooting for you. I was hoping you would win. And I'm like, you know what? Get out of my face. You know, obviously. But the guy, they said there were instances where he would get up out of his chair and cheer for a certain fighter. And I'm like, can you allow him to judge? You know, now they have a lot of scrutiny now with a lot of the amateur officials on USA Boxing. Where, like, you know, these guys can get, you know, not called for assignments. In college, you didn't get that.
What about in the pro ranks in this situation, if you have a controversial fight, and, you know, whether it's the media or the experts or, you know, fans, whatever.
Well, a lot of that's going to come down to the rule. The commission.
You have to have an immediate rematch. You know, why not do something simple?
Neutral grounds. This fight was a 12 rounder, right? Was it for a title, like NABF or USBA or?
No, it was for a title shot.
It was not, because sometimes what can happen there is if there's a title fight, even if it's a world title fight, and the score is controversial, the sanctioning body, and even like I said, even if it's a minor title like NABF, USBA, or you know, WBC, Intercontinental, all that bullshit. They can come out there and say, you know what, we're ordering a rematch. This fight was controversial, we're ordering a rematch, and sometimes they've actually put the rematch in a neutral ground. Now, here's an example of it, and I'm going back about 17 years ago. Right after Bernard Hopkins had lost his first title fight against Roy Jones back in 93, you know, Jones was the champion, Bernard was still the number one contender. Jones moves up to super middleweight, so now they're going to have the number one and two, number two contenders fighting for the title, that being Bernard Hopkins and Segundo Mercado from Ecuador. Mercado was promoted by Don King. King wins the purse bid. They had the fight in Ecuador. Now, Hopkins pretty much beat the shit out of him, except for two knockdowns that he had against him, mostly flash knockdowns, but over that, he won like the other 10 rounds pretty convincingly. Goes to the distance, it's a draw. The WBC, I believe it was the WBC or was it the IBF? I think it was the IBF. The IBF mandated a rematch in neutral ground. They fought down in Maryland and Hopkins knocked them out. That was a situation where a fight was deemed controversial. It was a draw, so the guys were still obviously the number one and number two contender. So you have the chance. Hello?
Oh, there you go.
Oh. All right.
You know, I faded out there for a minute.
Did you hear my rant about the Hopkins and Mercado situation?
Yeah, you were very rapid.
Well, you know, Tony, that judge that said that to you, I mean, first off, that was so disgracefully unprofessional. But obviously, he didn't care what you knew. He wasn't even concerned about any kind of sanctions. You know, and because, you know, Rich, I was thinking of your email last night with some of the suggestions you had. And I thought, well, maybe immediately if, you know, and we've heard Atlas say this, but it would be perhaps a deterrent. I mean, maybe even if there's nothing that can be done about the fight that was so misscored, perhaps if the commissioner would call each one of those judges into his office that week and say, now we're going to watch this thing together, and you're going to explain to me how you're scoring these rounds. You see what I mean?
All right. I don't know what happened there. Got a little brain freeze on my computer's part. But see if we can get the show back on the road here. Looks like we have no callers on the episode here. I'm going to try to... I know I just got Leon's number in a press release, so I'm going to try that number and connect him. See if he's available. So I assumed he would call in, but you know what happens when you assume. Anyway, you were just finishing up your Hopkins story there.
What I was saying was, you know, when we're talking about judging here, you know, a lot of times we're talking about, like, immediate rematches. Like, if you have a state commission, I don't think they have the authority to mandate a rematch. But if two guys fight in Pennsylvania, and, like, they fight on the card that happens to be in Philadelphia, and fight the controversially, I don't think the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission can mandate an immediate rematch. Now, they can possibly suspend the judges. So, but I think what you're really going to need more than anything is strong commissions. I don't know how strong the Athletic Commission is. You know, Pennsylvania, with Greg Sorb, is a very strong commission. There have been controversial fights where he is, I mean, not that he could reverse him or anything, but he has built a very strong base of officials. Now, great. Now I said this. Now, but he's built a very strong base of referees, judges, musicians. So you, not that you don't run into it here, but I think that's going to be your first, you know, stepping stone. Also, I think you need to have a national commission. You need to. Now, if they need somebody to run it, I'm free. I'll do it. Because you look at it like this. Now, okay, and I'm going to take a guy as an example who I know very well, a guy with his name, Gary Rosado. He was the referee of the Cunningham Adamack fight a few weeks ago. Jesus Christ, I just said you don't have shit like this in Pennsylvania, and we had a shitty decision in Pennsylvania 2 weeks ago. I shot myself in the ass. I'm interested to see what happens to those judges from that fight. Let's take a guy like Gary Rosado. Now, Gary is based out of Pennsylvania. He's worked his way up as a licensed official in the state of Pennsylvania. Now, say he does something and gets suspended from the state of Pennsylvania where he cannot officiate. He is still now, he's also a licensed official, I know, in Connecticut, because I've seen fights from the Mohican Sun where he's officiated. And I believe he's also doing fights, some fights down in Delaware, Jersey. So he's got like a part of that tri-state area where he's officiating. So if he gets suspended in Pennsylvania, there's no national commission where he would not be able to officiate in a state like, you know, New Jersey or Delaware. Steve Smoker. Now, Steve Smoker is one of the best referees in the world right now, if not the best referee. And I see him because he does a lot of the local Philadelphia cards. And I see him down there and I talk to him. Hell of a nice guy, a great official. But Steve's a guy that, like, say he got, for whatever reason, he was doing a fight in New York and he did something and he got suspended. I'd probably still see him in Philadelphia the next weekend. So I think that's when you need a national commission. You get these judges that got suspended in Atlantic City a year or so ago for that Paul Williams, Arisandi Lara fight. That doesn't say they can't apply and get licensed in the state of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
the problem.
Point.
Yeah, I'm so that most of my great state of Pennsylvania and our great athletic commission and what great our judges are and where the hell was that shitty decision 2 weeks ago.
Maybe Tom is not with us. Tom,
yeah. Oh, I'm here. Just got back. Here we are.
right. Well, I'm trying to add Leon to the call here. I just got to type in his name here and hit add for the contact. And hopefully we can connect him. And apologize for being a little late there with him. And we got, I forgot to mention, we have Scott Casper, a Takedown Radio Wrestling founder and host. He's going to talk all about wrestling a little bit later. We're going to have him on at around 9:15 Eastern. But hopefully we can get Leon's perspective here, because so far it's been nothing but the prosecution and no defense. So the longest we've talked about boxing, I think, to start a show in a long time. But yeah, it's one of those situations where, you know, I know Leon mentioned a couple bad decisions that he admitted in other fights. So I would at least, if he doesn't agree with this is a bad decision, I would at least like to hear what he thinks can be done about other bad decisions. As a promoter, what he thinks about all that. So here he is.
Calling Warriors.com. Our offices will be closed from December 24th to January
6th. Well, I don't know what's going on there. I know I sent him a message yesterday, I believe it was, reminding him and asking for a link to the file. When to call in and what number to call. So maybe he's just listening and said, I can't fight with these guys. That's going to be a losing effort. Who knows? But maybe if I send him an email, he might be one of those people that ends up getting his email right on his phone. That sounded like it was his business number, so he probably has a cell phone. Let's try to send him an email to call in. Anyway, we do have a big Strike Force event coming up this weekend. This is the last final hurrah for Strike Force. Big main event between Mark Quark and Safadine. And, of course, Daniel Cormier is fighting his last fight in Strike Force. But, have you got a chance to look at that card, Tom?
No, not much. Like I said, the emphasis has been on boxing this week, and I just haven't delved into Strikeforce too much. I feel kind of emotional about it, you know, kind of sad. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it always seemed to me like it was one of those situations where they didn't publicly want it to fail. They didn't announce it like, hey, you know, we're buying this to make it fail. But it didn't take long for it to look like that was their plan.
Yeah.
They started picking this off and just made it a point to lessen the value of it to the point where Showtime didn't want anything to do with it. And it wasn't that they didn't want anything to do with MMA, because now you see reports that they're still interested in MMA. So the other thing is, if it was all about the TV deal, how can you be such a big organization like the UFC and Zuffa in general there and not be able to arrange a TV deal when you've got deals with pay-per-view, you've got deals with all the Fox channels? I mean, something could have been worked out, I think.
Yeah.
We'll see who makes the cut. I know that the big story in recent weeks is where Josh Barnett's going to be ending up, because he's got some bad blood with Dana White.
But I think I remember seeing a quote from Josh, though, that he said, well, he said, if I end up in the UFC, fine, I just want to fight. So I guess he's willing to extend the olive branch. Now we'll see what Dana does.
Yeah. The other thing, famous guy, well, famous for bad-mouthing Strikeforce anyway, King Mo LaWall is also in the news this week. Now he's turning into the Bo Jackson of combat sports here. He's already doing TNA wrestling, which is also a Viacom outfit. He's going to be debuting in Bellator in a couple weeks, and now today there's a story out there. He wants to box. There's a boxing contract, or there's a boxing clause in his contract, and he wants to fight Kimbo Slice. Surprise, surprise. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see how that develops.
Well,
I'm sending Leon an email here.
Well, it's at any time, and I mentioned this a couple of years ago, Kimbo right now is more of a name than anything, and a name equals dollars. It's the truth. I remember, like I said, a couple of years ago when I was writing that column, Fantasy Dream Fights,
yeah.
One of the first things that I said in my intro article that I was talking about what I was going to be debuting was, don't ask me to compare guys like, you know, Kimbo Slice or Anderson Silva or any of those guys until they have a sanctioned boxing match. And well, I know Kimbo was the one I said, don't ask me what would happen if Tyson fought Kimbo until Kimbo steps in the ring. And I remember a year or two later when he finally did, you emailed me and you said, well, now is the time you can write that article. I said, oh, come on. You have to write an article in 20 seconds. Kimbo's three most impressive boxing matches, the only three he's had, that he, you know, knocked out guys I've never heard of in less than 30 seconds. And that's about how long the Tyson fight's going to last, except he's not going to be the one doing the knocking out. He's going to be the one on the receiving end of it.
Yeah. All right, I think we have Leon. Leon, can you hear us? Mr. Margula, is he there? Someone's on the call. Who's calling in here? Hello? Hello? Anybody? 515 area code we got on here.
Fellas, it's Scott Casper from Takedown Wrestling. How are you?
Oh, Scott's early. All right. You called in.
I heard you were having some trouble with Lance. I figured, you know what? I'm going to jump in now while you guys do your best to connect with him. And I'll take Leon's time. He can take mine. How about that?
He doesn't want to participate. You get extra time. I like that idea.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take extra time anytime I can get it for the sport of wrestling. How are you guys?
Great. Scott, we were just talking about King Mo. I know you've been pretty friendly with him over the years. What do you think about him getting into boxing?
Well, I think King Mo and mixed martial arts are a natural. King Mo and professional wrestling are a natural. As far as Mo and boxing, I don't know. You know, any number of fighters think they are, you know, great boxers as well. Boxing and wrestling don't necessarily go hand in hand, but I'll tell you what, you can ask Antonio Inoki, a famed pro wrestler and a great mat wrestler himself, and Muhammad Ali in that competition, what that one ended up like in Japan.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember reading Classic Freddie Blassie's, you know, because he was working Ali's corner for that fight, and because he obviously knew Inoki, and he was just saying it was just so ugly because, you know, Ali got one over there thinking everything was going to be scripted, and he asked when there was going to be the rehearsals, and they looked at him, and then he thought they were backstabbing him, and it just turned really ugly really fast.
Yeah, it's you know what? World of Pro Wrestling is a wonderful show, and I enjoy it, but when it comes to real athletes doing really good stuff for serious money, like boxers or mixed martial artists or our wrestling athletes on the mats, whether it's at the collegiate level or the Olympic level or world level, I'll tell you what, it's an amazing departure. King Mo can bring it. He's proven it out as a fighter, and certainly he's proven it out as a wrestler. I remember announcing him at Hilton Coliseum in Ames, Iowa, when he won his Big 12 title. And I remember he said, please don't call me Muhammad. He said, call me Mo. It was right around the time of 9/11, and he was a little fearful of any kind of backwash, if you will, from the using the name Muhammad. But his, you know, Muhammad is Mo, and Mo Lawal can wrestle and he can fight. I think we're also going to see The Entertainer come out and as he starts to make an impact in TNA wrestling with Hulk Hogan and all those guys down there. They're a wonderful group of folks. But man, I tell you what, when it comes to that fighting company, Bellator, I think Mo's got his work cut out for him.
I can hear you.
He forgot. Leon forgot. Well, maybe we'll try to get him in at the very end of the show now. And hopefully we'll get still get some time with Scott here. I don't know if I'm going to have to call Scott or what's going on there. But we'll give him a couple minutes, see if he gives us a ring. But let's see what we can do here. All right. Well, in the meantime, I got a couple interesting stories here. We have some rumors going around about Ronda Rousey reportedly making up to $150,000 for her main event fight coming up. And Dana White has come out and said, no, that's not true. But a little bit of a blip on the radar this week. People have been talking about. Dana White also made the news this week saying that the NFL is less safe than the UFC, as far as concussions go. Concussion is a huge dilemma right now for the NFL, says White. Here's the difference between the UFC and the NFL as far as concussions are concerned. First of all, if you get a concussion, if you get knocked out or you get hurt whatsoever in the UFC, 3-month suspension. You are on suspension for 3 months, and you cannot come back until you are cleared by a doctor. You can't have any contact whatsoever. In the NFL, you're not going to lose Tom Brady for 3 months, man. You lose Tom Brady for 3 months, and your whole season is wiped out. So the UFC, listen, we don't hide from it. It's a contact sport, and that's what these guys do. It's much safer. In the 20-year history of the UFC, it'll be 20 years in November, there has never been a death or serious injury. Never been a death or serious injury in 20 years because we go above and beyond when it comes to the safety of these guys. When you know you have two healthy athletes getting ready to compete, they get the proper medical attention before and after. It's the safest sport in the world. Fact. Now, I've talked about this before. There was a study done that showed that per capita, per fight, and you know, the amount of fights in boxing and MMA is obviously there's more boxing going on than MMA, but on a per-fight basis, it's more common for MMA guys to get concussions. Now, whether these suspensions are greater for boxing or MMA, I don't know. And there is a huge study going on right now with MMA guys and boxers in I think it's in Las Vegas, where they're taking a look at the brain injury situation. But I know it's kind of a cheap shot to take NFL against UFC. I mean, these guys are hitting each other with helmets. So, there's a lot more running down the field and speed involved and a lot more different dynamics, I think.
Well, what do you think his point was? What's his the whole end game of that rant? What do you think?
I just think he's always been sort of jealous of the NFL. He's always tried to compare his organization to the NFL and saying that they're going to be bigger than them someday.
Well, we're talking apples and oranges.
Right. And I think he's just trying to take a cheap shot at them, just to try to show that in one category, at least, we're better than them.
Well, I didn't know they were in competition. I mean, I don't know.
Especially now that they're on Fox, you know, they got to be nice to each other. You know, they're promoted by the same network. So you think...
I can appreciate where you want to win and you want to, you know, put the best product out there and you want to, you know, make money and have the highest ratings. I can appreciate that. But when you bash your competition, first of all, you know, in my eyes, that turns me off. You know,
exactly.
I'm watching, you know, I'm a big pro wrestling fan. So back in the 90s, you always had what they called the Monday Night Wars. You had WWE, who was WWF at the time, and they were kind of hurting. And you had WCW with Ted Turner's money, and they were really jumping ahead. And they were really doing well. And then there was a few guys in WWE that were still kind of popular, the Stone Cold, Steve Austin, The Rock, Mick Foley, and these guys were still, you know, doing pretty good. And the WCW announcers were referencing their competition, trying to tell you we're better. Here's what they're going to do tonight. Well, you know, and that's the one thing happened when Mick Foley won the title, and he was very popular. You know, they said that match was taped a week ago, and he's going to win the title. And they said like a couple hundred thousand channels changed to watch him win the title. So not only did you make yourself look bad, like, you know, trashing your competition unnecessarily, but you cost yourself a lot of viewers. And that's the thing. People are going to get so turned on. I mean, I've never been a Dana White fan, so I'm quick to criticize him. But people are going to get so turned off by always hearing, we're better. Don't watch boxing. It's no good. Don't buy this boxing pay-per-view because, you know, Floyd Mayweather's not going to fight. He's going to run. Oh, don't watch the NFL because they don't protect their athletes. You know, but we are the saints and we are the kings and we do everything so perfectly. Well, people are going to say, well, when something bad happens, well, I thought you were so perfect and why were you trashing this? Or you put on a pay-per-view and it was bad and you trashed this Mayweather pay-per-view and it just happened to be good. I mean, Cotto was a good fight. You know?
Exactly.
Hello, Scott.
Yes.
Hey, we're back. We had a little technical difficulty there.
Are you back on my computer then?
Sure.
Okay, let me do that. I'll call you back in 1 minute.
All right.
But you know, Tony, to your point, I think that you're attacking a lot of the similar audience. I mean, I think there can be a lot of crossover with action physical sports like football, boxing, MMA. I mean, there's plenty of room to go around, I think.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, just because I'm a big-time boxing fan, it doesn't mean I'm not going to watch football. It doesn't mean I'm not going to watch baseball. It doesn't mean, you know, there's some UFC fights that I want to watch. You know, I don't see the National Football League saying, you know what, we're having this big game tonight. I know, you know, Major League Baseball players are going off at the same time, but don't watch the Major League Baseball playoffs. Baseball's not exciting in football.
Right.
Do that. I mean, who cares? This is the Yankees and the Red Sox playing tonight. People go, oh, shit, Yankees and Red Sox are playing? Oh, that's a huge rivalry. I want to tune into that. Well, you just screwed yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see what else we got. Usually is going to be fighting Hector Lombard. It's a big story that came out this week. The fans asked for it, and they got it. And here's Scott. Scott, we got you back.
Fellas, how are you? Sorry about the technical issues, but I am back, and so are you guys.
All right. Well, Scott, the reason I thought it would be a great time to have you back, I saw a notice that you sent out that you just got added to Time Warner Cable. Tell us a little bit about your show and how it's grown over the years and how proud of it you are, I guess.
Yeah, well, we are very proud. Thanks for bringing it up. Hey, here's the deal, guys. We've been doing a college wrestling television or radio show for 16 years. It's now heard in 52 countries. You can hear it on iHeartRadio. It's called Takedown Wrestling Radio. I knew we could do a TV show, and we started experimenting with it about 4 years ago, and that was 200 episodes ago. And that show, with the addition of Upstate Time Warner, that puts us at about 53 million homes starting January 14th. At a variety of different outlets, including Sports Time Ohio, Time Warner, Cablevision, Cox Cable, Comcast, and a variety of markets, Mediacom throughout the Midwest. It's such an incredible group of Midcoast Sports Network, but it's such an incredible group of networks that we've knitted together to be able to put it out to 53 million homes every week, with full cooperation from the Big Ten Network, USA Wrestling, all the affiliates. It's really been a wonderful experience putting the whole thing together. And 2 years ago, we started producing a sister program for our Olympic movement called USA Wrestling, and that's a weekly show as well. So you have one show that focuses on guys from their freshman year in college all the way through their senior year to the point where they start wrestling at the Olympic or world level until they're completed with their competition years. So it can take, you know, we can develop our stars now and work with them over a period of 8, 10, some of them 20 years. And that's something we've never had before. So we're very, very fortunate to be able to tell the story of a sport that is the oldest sport known to mankind. It's the oldest sport. You can find it in the Bible. Jacob was wrestling the angel of the Lord. You can find a document that we uncovered at Columbia that is actually from ancient Sumer, I believe it is, and it's on papyrus, and it's actually a wrestling how-to manual on a piece of broken-up papyrus.
Amazing. It just the how the sport has grown so tremendously, and now you have MMA's influence on it. And last time I saw you, I was out in Las Vegas at Randy Couture's gym at a submission grappling event, which is the first time I've ever seen that sport. And it's just amazing how many people are involved. There was even a kid there who had half a leg, and he got to the finals.
Well, that's maybe the best part about wrestling, Rich, is that wrestling is all enveloping. It welcomes everybody at any weight, any height. My God, I just did an event in Chicago, the 50th edition of the Midlands, and we had two guys, 151 and 153, that are competing in the Midlands for their 16th and 17th consecutive event. think about that. They or 16th and 17th time they've competed in that event, I should say. So you figure that out. The wrestling is a very welcoming sport. It's all about how you compete. You know, you can take a great boxer. Can you turn him into a great wrestler? Probably not. But can you take a wrestler and turn him into a decent fighter? I think we've proven that out with guys like Randy Couture, Matt Lindland, Pat Miletich. I mean, we turned some incredible wrestlers into outstanding fighters.
Now, you've obviously interviewed a ton of people over the years. What interviews in your mind stand out as some of the best?
You know, I think that it depends on the time of year. I'd like to believe that some of our Olympic-level athletes have been phenomenal. We just announced an event, or I should say I announced an event at Madison Square Garden, and it was a who's who on the floor, and my job was to not only announce the action as it took place and introduce teams and athletes, but also to do on-camera interviews for the big screen in-house. We had Frankie Edgar, we had Billy Baldwin, Dan Gable, some of the guys from the World Wrestling Entertainment Company were there, Jack Swagger and several of the other guys and old guys that have are still in management of the WWE, like Gerald Briscoe. So, you know, that was an incredible day. We put about 11,000 people into Madison Square Garden, that famed arena. My dressing room was the same dressing room Muhammad Ali used for that fight in 71, the fight of the century against Frazier. So it was, you know, it's, I don't know that you could pick one particular part of the year or one particular interview, but I tell you what, when college wrestling's at its finest, some of the worst interviews are your top coaches. Like Cale Sanderson may not be the best interview in the world, even though his team is number one and has been for the last three consecutive years.
Yeah, that's a hell of a story he has, too, with him coming back out of retirement there.
You know, I think you're right. You have some great people from around the country who are doing outstanding things. Wrestling, by the way, where it was in trouble as a collegiate sport, we've gone from 300-some programs down to 75 at the Division I level. Well, now we're starting to add programs back. Over the last 18 months, we haven't lost a program. We've had a net gain of some 18 programs at a variety of different levels. We're seeing opportunities for kids to wrestle at all these different schools, at the club level, the NEI, Division III, II, I, and junior college. Kids are providing these institutions, a lot of them, with much-needed income. Some of these schools have 40 kids at $28,000 a year. You're looking at, you know, $1.5 million, perhaps, of income for a university that desperately needs male students and desperately needs income. Wrestling is providing a great opportunity for these kids and these institutions. Well, they're providing great educational opportunities. I think we need to look at wrestling for what it is. Great activity, wonderful team building, great leadership opportunities for kids and learning opportunities that come out and be great business leaders. We have fellows that are contributing to the sport of wrestling right now that are billionaires, and I'm saying with a B. They wrestled at either Princeton or they wrestled at Columbia or wherever they wrestled. They are contributing big time money. I just interviewed Joshua Harris, and Joshua is the owner of the Philadelphia 76ers, the basketball team. And we're looking at about $2.5 billion in net worth. Fellas, you learn something in wrestling. You work, and what you get out of it, and so what you put into it, you get out of that, get out of it that much more. It's a wonderful thing. Tom Brands likes to boil it down to, you know, the simple thing of whether or not the kid does a good job. And when they wrestle at that level, Division I, they're doing a good job. Whether or not the coach does a good job, he took it on himself. They won 7 of 3 matches. It was 39-9, I think, the final score. But he was upset with himself for the missed opportunities. Got to remember, they won 7 of 10. 7 of 10 bouts. And he was very upset in the press conference about his inability to get these guys to gel together as a team to do what they needed to do.
Yeah, it's one of those sports, especially with the team aspect of it, that can swing on one match, one outcome. With, I know I've seen it in person where I was kind of pivotal in one of our big rivalry matches. They told me to go out there, and I had to make weight for 189 when I weighed about 165 going into the match.
Well,
they sent me out there against a three-time state champ, and the kid, they said, don't get pinned. Just don't get pinned, whatever you do. And the kid put me in a pretzel, pinned me in 2 seconds. And it's probably my worst match ever.
I want coaches to eliminate that phrase. Don't go out there and just don't get pinned. If I never hear a coach say that again, it will be too soon. Never. I want them to say, get out there and give it your best. If you get pinned, you know, so what? Don't even say it. Don't bring it up. Every kid wants to go out there and do his best. He doesn't want that in his head. I don't want to go out and get pinned. God knows, Rich Bergeron, you may not have been the best wrestler. I guarantee you, I wasn't. But I never wanted to hear anybody say, just don't go get pinned. I want somebody to pin a hope on me. You know what I mean? Hey, by the way, Jay Robinson, Minnesota's division leading and NCAA champion level coach, Jay Robinson, has been sidelined with a terrible knee infection. He's being treated right now at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Won't be traveling with the team to Ohio or Indiana, but we want to wish Jay Robinson, famed Olympic-level coach and collegiate-level coach, a speedy recovery. What a tremendous guy he is. But he's the one that developed our modern-day military combatives, which are loosely based on Russian Sambo. He's the one that developed all the rules for our military at all levels, and they're called military combatives. And I tell you what, Jay Robinson deserves a lot of credit for how mixed martial arts has evolved because of what he did with the military.
We just saw the winner of the Ultimate Fighter, Colton Smith, use that to his advantage in his win there in MMA. Just totally blew me away because I didn't expect him to win that finale match. And a lot of that stuff, just to held the guy tight to him through the whole thing and just didn't even let him get any separation. I was really impressed with that. And that's a lot to do with his military background and training.
I got to ask you guys a question. Before we experienced technical difficulties earlier, you're talking about King Mo the Wall. How much of that conversation did you guys catch from me? And what are your thoughts on Mo the Wall splitting his time between mixed martial arts and professional wrestling?
I called it the boat action sport. He's beating Kimbo. It might be Kimbo's best competition yet. But, I think that MMA is becoming a lot more of a striker's game because of the fan mentality. They want to see these brutal, stand-up fights. And you're seeing more and more fights rely on two main disciplines, wrestling. The takedowns are like your takedown radio, perfect example. The takedowns are huge in scoring. And the fans love the striking. And judges like it too, I think. But, I think you're seeing less BJJ and way more wrestling and striking.
Yeah, I tell you what, there's a good Brazilian jiu-jitsu artist will be very exciting on one hand, and if he doesn't have any wrestling ability, though, then it becomes a bit of a stand-up. But I really like a guy that can hang, hang and bang, and Mo the Wall can throw. He may not be the best striker in the world. He may not be like a Tyron Woodley as far as fast hands. He may not have the strength of a Cain Velasquez, but I'll guarantee you, he's a tremendous athlete, and he has an incredible amount of showmanship to him. He told me years ago he wanted to be a pro wrestler, and gosh knows the people at TNA and Bellator are allowing him that opportunity to do both, to compete and to perform.
well, what amazes me more than anything is this is a guy who was virtually on the brink of death not too long ago. He was really serious in the hospital. So it's just a great human interest story in that respect.
Yeah. Mo, I've done a lot of work with Mo over the years, traveling with Mo and performing with Mo in a variety of different ways. I have so much respect for him. What he did in Las Vegas with the Athletic Commission, and I caution him, just shut your mouth. Yeah, there's nothing good going to come out of it. Have somebody else do your talking. Fighters should never, ever talk to a commission unless it is to answer a question. And oh my goodness sakes, that was a tough one right there. Anyway, that's
well,
it, fellas.
So,
this
weekend is the last event for Strikeforce, of course, and he also famous for saying Strikeforce is like a dying cancer patient.
Do you feel bad? I mean, did you not expect the UFC would allow Strikeforce to die?
Oh, Dana White's been out in the press lately saying that it's not what they planned. That's garbage. People that are saying that, but this is building the evidence of trying to prove they're out to kill it from the beginning. I mean, all the pieces of the puzzle are there. Every exhibit you could point.
Pulling
to.
Weight classes, pulling talent, destroying dates and date opportunities. Sometimes, you know, Dana can be his own worst enemy. You've got to have competition to sharpen your product. That's what's made the UFC the driving force that it is. And if you don't have competition, WWF has proven it with the absence of the WCW in professional wrestling, now with the absence of any solid contender, to the throne other than the UFC, I think you'll see the product continue to suffer. There needs to be proving grounds that are able to be, you know, marketed worldwide, not just here across the United States, but in Europe as well, in Japan. You've got to have people that help you, drive you to be better than even you think you can be.
And it was interesting that the Showtime thing is what killed it, because I don't often get a chance to be on conference calls and get involved in a lot of the press releases that come out of the UFC, and because Strikeforce is connected with Showtime and I get stuff for Showtime, I got on a conference call one time and Scott Coker was there, and it was just after they got rid of the heavyweights. They said they were going to bring them all over to the UFC, basically, and that the Grand Prix was going to be the last event. So I asked Scott Coker, do you see a time after this is happening with the heavyweights where Strikeforce would be folded completely into the UFC? And he basically said, our partnership with Showtime is strong, and as long as that partnership can do well. They fell apart. But I was just, the UFC has so many different TV interests. They could have easily found somebody if they really wanted to take that over.
The UFC, I think, is running a very dangerous line of providing too much product to the masses, and I think eventually you'll start seeing it fray its numbers for pay-per-view. I think we may be already seeing that, but as the UFC continues to grow in its China effort, they will become as big, if not bigger, than ESPN's. You got to remember, Fox Sports, and they haven't released it yet, but mark my words, Fox Sports will go head-to-head with ESPN with a brand-new product called Fox Sports 1. Fox Sports 1 will replace Speed, and you will see Fox Sports 1, 2, and 3. And they already own so much of the NFL product, Major League Baseball, and many other products and events. Fox Sports will become a dominant player, will challenge ESPN. They've got some great on-air talent, but they also have a great relationship with the UFC. So mark my words, within the next 2-3 months, you will start seeing and hearing about the new Fox Sports One and what it's going to be doing. One of the major elements, one of the major components, is the fight component. And believe me, Fox News Corp has not failed at anything they've done. When they challenged CNN, that won when they challenged the cable industry to add another network. Are you kidding me? Look at what they did with NBC, ABC, CBS. Fox has done everything that they wanted to do, and they will continue to do it. So watch out. I'm telling my friends at ESPN, watch these guys. ESPN, believe me, is preparing for this. It's going to be a great battle. But one of those components, big components, is the fight component.
Anybody else got any questions? I feel like I'm
hogging
this one.
Yeah,
well,
we're
not. The one question I was going to ask
you. One at a time.
Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, you go ahead, Tony.
Well, basically, I was going to ask, because, you know, we were talking so much about the wrestling on the collegiate level, and the college that I'm an alma mater from, an alumnus, I should say, is Lock Haven University. We were a wrestling powerhouse. In the 90s, I had the opportunity. I boxed for Lock Haven, so it was funny because some of the wrestlers, we were fortunate enough that our boxing head coach was Dr. Ken Cox. He was very well known in the wrestling field, and he had a good the wrestling coaches. And we would actually go over there, talk to them sometimes. They would give us some of their tips on, you know, just getting in shape and making weight, which was tremendously helpful to me when I was cutting weight. And we learned a lot from them, and then I was fortunate enough, like the boxing season and the wrestling season kind of overlapped. So on certain weekends, the wrestling team, if they were home, I might not be home. I might be at Navy or VMI or, you know, Penn State. But the one time that I had a weekend off, I wasn't fighting, was the weekend when Penn State and Lock Haven had a blue meet on the campus of Lock Haven. And I got to see guys like Carrie Colad, who I became pretty good friends with, compete right in person. And I was amazed at how, you know, tremendous he was with his speed and his athleticism.
Let me tell you something. Lock Haven has had a storied history. They just had a tremendous weekend as that program continues the road back. Title IX has been devastating to great programs with great histories like Lock Haven. But the win that they had this last weekend, they won 6 of 10 bouts, sealed with Maldarelli's out of Merrick, New York, with his big win at 49. But they beat West Virginia, guys, 19-15. It was a thriller for sure. But
nice.
I got to tell you, Tom, that, you know, this Lock Haven is coming back. Mark my words. You look at guys like Garcia and Phil Sprankle and Harry Turner and these kids. They're all doing their best. And you got the great coaching staff there with a tremendous history in the state of Pennsylvania that only looks to continue to do what they're doing. I mean, you look at that staff. They've got a great history, and I think in the next 2 to 3 years you're going to start seeing Lock Haven reemerge. Robbie Waller and Scotty Moore and Brad Pataki are all credentialed guys, and they're attracting credentialed wrestlers again.
I remember, like I was telling you, the one meet that I was able to go to because I had that weekend off, I wasn't fighting, and it happened to be the weekend of the big Penn State Lock Haven dual meet. This was back in 1996, and my one friend that I went to the matches with, he actually was recruited to go to Lock Haven to wrestle, and then he decided not to. He decided to forego. He's like, you know what, I did it in high school enough. I'm tired of cutting the weight. All I want to do is focus on my academics now. But so I went. He lived across the dorm from me, and we were friends. So he's like, hey, let's go in this dual meet. Well, I really didn't understand it. But he was sitting there and he's kind of explaining things. And then he came up to like the fifth or sixth match of the night was Carrie Colat. And he was wrestling a kid from Penn State. And he was taking him down. He would let him up and then he'd just take him down again. And I turned to this kid, Carrie, I said, why did you let him up like that? He goes, well, he doesn't have him in a position to flip him or pin him. So he's letting him up, he's giving up a point because he's taking him down so quick, and then he's getting 2 points, and then he's trying to get him in a better position to go for pin. And I said,
That's right.
I said, well, is that guy not really that good that he's taking him down so easy? And Gary Delaney, that guy's an All-American. He goes, good. He's on the mat with great right now.
You know, Kerry Collett's banner's hanging in that field house at Lock Haven for a reason. He's one of the collegiate wrestlers of the modern era. He's coaching down in North Carolina now. And I have so much respect for Kerry Collett as a wrestler, as a teacher, as a technician. He can teach. He can coach. I'm looking forward to seeing what the next 10 years looks like on Kerry Collett's resume as a coach. But his history is well documented, and it's cemented firmly in Lock Haven. Good call out of you, Tom. Good call indeed.
That was Tony, by the way.
I'm sorry, Tony. Well, there you go. I can't. It's my connection. So this was – I was actually asking or answering the question for the Tornado.
The Tornado.
Tornado.
All right, Tony. I'm sorry, man.
Now it's time.
It's okay. I'll tell you, one of our weekend events in Penn State, he had to miss because he was getting inducted into the PSAC Wrestling Hall of Fame. So, you know, we busted his balls a little bit. Come on, you're missing our fights. You're not going to work our corner. What are we going to do? And he was laughing. He was joking. And he said, guys, I'm going down there. And they're going to give me a plaque, and this is going to be great. I can hang in. We're laughing with him. So he comes back, and he shows us the plaque. And then he shows us the picture of him getting the plaque presented to him. Now, like I said, I really didn't know much about the 96 Olympics, aside from David Reed winning the gold medal for the United States boxing team. And Muhammad Ali lighted the torch when he was trembling with the fingers. So I see a picture, I go, Doc, I said, the guy standing next to you looks pretty big. I said, you know, who's he? Is he somebody important? I think it's somebody important. He goes, Kurt Angle, 1996 U.S. gold medalist. I didn't know.
Right.
A couple years later, me being a big pro wrestling fan, there I am at the matches in my Kurt Angle T-shirt, you know, cheering them on. And, you know, I always root for the bad guys anyway, so.
If you look at all the success that those schools have had, you look at Clarion with Wade Chalice and Kurt Angle and guys like that, Bob Bubb, et cetera, and then you look at Lock Haven and you look at Bloomsburg. Bloomsburg just beat Maryland. So these small – and Pitt, what has Pittsburgh been doing other than ruling the roost? Oh, my goodness, Pittsburgh's beating everybody. So these smaller schools in Western PA and Central PA are – Bucknell is just committing some $3.5, $4 million for Mr. Graham to build a brand-new wrestling facility. And this is a program that was actually canceled and brought back some 6 months later by a very active athletic director. And then, of course, the financing from Mr. Graham. So the Pennsylvania wrestling right now is reaching a fever pitch, and it's not just, you know, PSAC, it's PSAL, it's all these incredible athletes that are in that state, but they're going elsewhere. By the way, Mac Maldarelli, I was telling you about him a little bit ago, is the athlete of the week. The athlete of the week in the PSAC, Mac Maldarelli from Lock Haven.
Oh, really?
Well, we're going to let Tom ask a question here, and then unfortunately we have to cut it a little short because we've got to get Leon on real quick, and we're probably going to do a bonus round with him. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, Scott, you know, for years I think we could, you know, and I'm talking going back to the 60s and 70s and through the 80s, wrestling was considered, for lack of a better phrase, the Rodney Dangerfield of the martial arts because it didn't get the respect, okay?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, when MMA came along, those early UFCs, we started seeing how effective grappling was with BJJ, and then we'll go back to the Dan Severn days, Mark Coleman. You know, when these guys started to come in, people realized how effective wrestling is. And now it does get all the credit that it deserves. But my question to you is, why do you think it took so long for people to really appreciate wrestling? Now, I have my opinion on it, but I'd like to hear yours.
You know, it's an interesting. I had Dana White on my show a number of years ago, and he made the comment that he was trying to get rid of wrestling. Pat Miletich's camp was doing a great job of ruling the roost with the total number of titles, and they were majority of them were all wrestlers. And Dana said, "I'm going to do my best to get rid of wrestling out of mixed martial arts because fans want to see people stand and trade." Well, it was not maybe more than a year and a half, 2 years ago, I had Dana on again. I said, "Dude, are you happy that wrestling is still around? Are you happy you didn't kill it?" He said, "I never wanted to kill it." I played the clip for him. He said, "Well, what I meant to say..." Okay, he backpedaled, and I gave him that opportunity to tell people that he personally, and the Fertittas too, they personally fund a high school wrestling program in Nevada. They write the checks out themselves, not the UFC, but the Fertittas and White. The kids wrestle there. Their kids wrestle there. And guess who their coach is now? Ricky Lundell, one of the great BJJ guys in history, black belt, a tremendous young man, and walked on to Iowa State University. Kale Sanderson had no idea who he was or what kind of talent this young man possessed or how smart he is. Now look at what Frank Mir has been able to do to reinvigorate his career because of guys like Ricky Lundell. But Dana White has backtracked, and I believe that everybody is understanding that it's not just the Randy Couture's and the Matt Lindlands, but look at Johnny Hendricks right now. I mean, my God, he may be the happy beard man, but before that, he was the most hated man in college wrestling, a tremendous, tremendous wrestler, and an even better fighter to this day. I'm wondering if he's the rebirth or the reemergence of Dan Henderson. How about this guy? I think he's been denied his shot at the right time. I think he'll take it when he gets it. But, man, if there's a more deserving guy out there for a shot at the title, I don't know who it is.
Sure.
So I hope I answered your question. Psychic Tommy, I hope I answered your question, but I don't know why it's taken as long, but I think it's proven itself that wrestling ain't going anywhere. Like I said, it's the oldest sport known to mankind. We're not going anywhere, dude. We're getting bigger, badder, stronger, faster.
Exactly, and congratulations on the show expanding. I get Sports Time Ohio every day, and I'll sure be checking in. And real quick, I know we're up against the clock. My feeling is what some of the reasons were for wrestling not getting the respect is it's not that flashy. You know, I'm the old guy of this trio, and I remember going to the Kung Fu movies at the drive-in back in the early 70s. Boy, that's an embarrassing thing to admit. But, you know, it was the craze, the flash, the excitement, whereas wrestling is very practical. And sometimes it's not the flashiest thing. And there was also in the traditional martial arts community, well, we have techniques to make sure the fight doesn't go to the ground. Well, yeah. I think that MMA has shown that it's if a good wrestler wants you down, the odds are you're going to be flat in your back.
That's right.
And then maybe with there was some of the pro influence that people would hear it, and there was that little laugh reflex. Oh, wrestling! Yeah, I watch that all the time with the guys in the masks and the cape, and it's apples and oranges. I mean, pro wrestlers are great athletes, but we know that's entertainment. And we now know how hard the guys in the collegiate and high school level really work. So that's my take on it anyways.
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the more we tell the story and allow the sport to get back into mainstream athletics, I think the more it's going to continue to win and continue to grow. We just put 10,000 people into Madison Square Garden on a Sunday morning. We just set a world record for the Olympic trials at Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City, Iowa. We're going to continue to see record numbers as we promote the sport correctly. Instead of putting our head down and thinking everybody's going to come, we got to invite them. We got to clean up the barn, put up some drapes, invite people in, sell tickets. Don't give the sport away. Put a price on it. Sell tickets. Let me tell you what.
And I don't think that would.
Yeah.
I don't think that would have happened 30 years ago.
No,
you got to remember that. I want to give you a chance to give your final thoughts, tell people where to find you, all that stuff.
Okay, easy enough, fellas. And hey, thanks for having me on FNU Combat Sports Radio. You can listen to my radio show every Saturday from 9 to 11 Central Standard Time, 10 to noon Eastern at takedownradio.com. You can find us on iHeartRadio as well, / KXNO That's our home base flagship station. That's /KXNO. And just click on under sports on iHeartRadio. It's a free app. And listen to it around the world, 52 countries. 16 years we've been doing that. TV show, check your cable listings. Chances are we're on it. I think, Tony, you said you've got Sports Time Ohio. They air us five times a week, guys.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's been great having you, as always. We always enjoy chatting with you. I wish we had more time, but we got to get an interview that didn't pan out earlier on, and then what we're going to do is we're going to continue it on a bonus show that we're going to have to set up.
Well, guys, it's been a pleasure. Rich, Tony, Tom, thank you so
Scott
much. Anytime, give me a holler.
Been great, Scott.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks a lot. Hey, so we're going to try to connect to Leon here, and then what we're going to do is we're going to tape it on old program called Destiny. And if you guys want to stay on a little extra time.
Hello.
Hello, Leon.
Hello.
Hello, Leon.
Yes.
Hey, this is Rabble Rouser Richard.
Yes, you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Rich, do you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, good. I'm sorry, I completely forgot, and I had a very long day today, and when I got your email, I remembered, oh, damn, I was supposed to call this guy at 8:30.
That's all right. What we're going to do, we're going to run out of time here on this show in about 3 minutes, but we're going to just kind of chat with you to the end of the show, and then we're going to record it separately from the show and then set up on the same show page a bonus show, because we can just make a show anytime we want to in addition to our scheduled programming.
That's cool.
So we'll make up for lost time, basically.
No problem.
So we've had a lot of talk in the early part of the show about this fight between Barthelemy and Usmani. And I told you, I saw Barthelemy out in Vegas in all of his fights at the Cosmo. And I was actually kind of surprised that he was going up against Usmani with such a unblemished record until I heard the announcers talk about how they used to spar. Or they sparred at one point, and Barthelemy got the better of him.
I didn't see the sparring, but I heard that Barthelemy got the better of it.
Mm-hmm.
At least according to his management team.
Right. And what was your thoughts of setting up this fight for Barthelemy, and what was your expectations going in?
Well, I think Barthelemy's a very good fighter, and I think I thought he was going to win. I actually thought he was going to win, but easier than he did. Barthelemy is still a little bit of a work in progress. But when he fights tall and he works behind the jab, I think he's very difficult to beat for any 103-pounder. So we wanted, in fact, if you remember, I did a Showbox show last summer, and it was supposed to be a triple header, and it ended up being a double header. And the fight that fell out was Barthelemy's fight, and we were trying to do the fight against Usmani back then. So. It was a fight that was talked about and desired for a long time.
Obviously, there's a lot of controversy surrounding this one. I told you myself, I was rooting for Barthelemy, and at the same time, I really thought he started getting beat after about halfway through the third round. And you since come out and said that you thought it was much closer. And,
I thought it was a very close fight. I had Barthelemy winning. Most people in the arena either had Barthelemy winning or had it as a very close fight. If you've ever been in an arena where the hometown guy gets a bad decision, usually there's boos.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, there was no boos because in the arena, there was not a lot of people that thought we didn't win. Harold Letterman was there, I believe. I haven't spoken to him, so midway through the fight, I walked over to him and he said, a great fight, you know. But I didn't talk to him after the fight, so I don't want to say that he thought Bartholomew won. But there were some people in the arena who told me they thought he said he won. Now, since those parents from the Miami Herald thought Bartholomew won, and the guy from the El Herald thought Bartholomew won, they're longtime writers down here. And as you probably read my release, where taking a lot of criticism, I actually walked in the ring, walked across to the other side of the other corner, and I congratulated Tugue Bernas, the manager. I said, great fight, very, very close fight. He said, no, you won 8-4. And I said, why do you say that? I think it's closer than that. He said, no, you're going to get all the close rounds. So it wasn't like anybody was outraged other than Teddy. Because everybody in the arena seemed to feel like it was a close fight. It could go either way, and nobody was surprised that the hometown guy won.
Right.
And by the way, the judging was pretty consistent. It wasn't like the judging. A lot of times we see fights that are controversial, and the judging go all over the place. These are very consistent scores. 8-4 and 7-5. So I thought 8-4 was a little long. I had it 7-5. I had Bartholomew winning rounds 1, 2, 4, and 5. And I had him winning rounds 10 and 11. But I didn't have him. The other rounds, there were some close rounds. So I had him winning. And I picked him round up even, but I had him winning 7 to 5.
I had it 7-4 for Usmani. And my
that's okay. But by the way, that's okay. You're entitled to your opinion.
I just thought the thing that really surprised me, I was saying earlier about Bartholomew, was he started out very unconventional. Like, I never saw him at the Cosmopolitan in those fights. And it seemed he had so much confidence in those first two rounds. And
that's the way he trained to fight. Fortunately, he got lulled into a fight, the other guy's fight, when he should have continued to fight tall, work behind the jab like he did in the first two rounds, where he was busting Usmani up. Probably could have stopped him in four or five rounds if he had stayed with the fight plan.
Well, my theory about that is I think in his previous fights, when he did that, he could actually see the other guy withering in front of him, and that just gave him further confidence to the point where I saw him get one of those Cosmopolitan fights was a TKO. So he goes up against Usmani, and Usmani doesn't fade after everything that he throws at him. So I think he got frustrated in some of those middle rounds, and he went back to.
Yeah, he wanted to chunk too hard and knock him out. All he had was boxing. If he boxed Usmani for 12 rounds, he wins 12 rounds. He's taller, he's longer, I think he's more technically sound. I just think Randy has a habit of losing sight of what he can do, and I always call it, I said, Randy, you're the biggest guy on the planet, 130 pounds. Why do you want to fight small? Fight big, fight tall. You're unstoppable when you do. Look at Tommy Hearns tapes. Look at Diego Corrales tapes.
When I saw him out in Vegas, he had a very sort of stiff technical style where he's always elbows in, hands up. So for him to drop his hands and throw like that, I thought it was good. He was moving enough to make it work. But at the same time, I was very surprised that he went out of his his original style to just attack him like that. But
it was also his first camp with John David Jackson, so. They're teaching him different things, and he's learning and feeling comfortable and doing different things. So I still think he's a developing fighter. You know, he wasn't the Cuban guy that spent 400 amateur fights in Cuba. He was a guy that came to the United States when he was 17 years old, won the Florida Golden Gloves, couldn't go out for the national team because it was an Olympic year, and he was a Cuban defector. And really had half his amateur career in the United States. So he's a lot different than a lot of the Cuban guys that come here 400 or 500 fights into their career.
All right. Oh, I just wanted to do a quick check. Tom, can you hear us?
Yes. And, Leon, my question is, and you took the words out of my mouth about Bartholomew getting off the game plan, because after the first two rounds, it looked like he was in a groove. And as you say, he was fighting tall, he was fighting big, and had he continued to do that, it looked like he was in for, at the very least, a pretty lopsided decision, possibly even a stoppage. And then all of a sudden, by the middle rounds, I'm kind of scratching my head and saying, wow, you know, he's just digging in, and he was not the boss in those middle rounds. And I think that's where he gave away a lot of rounds that had he stuck to the game plan, it would have been a far easier night for him, perhaps. Now, I guess my question is, do you think he's really going to take a lesson out of this as far as fighting his fight? What do you think?
Well, we certainly hope so. I told him today, he was in my office today, and I said to him, you know, Rancis, you know, you got to look at the tape carefully to see if you did wrong and right, and you have to learn from this fight, because now you're number two in the world, and you know, you're probably going to fight for the title this year, and you it's not going to get easier. It's going to get harder.
Right.
Now, the 12th round, you can't dispute that it was all his mind. It probably had a lot to do with his corner saying, you got to knock him out.
There's two rounds that you don't know about. The one you do know about. Obviously, we know that Usmani's corner thought the fight was in doubt, and they told him they better go knock him out. And they were obviously right. The fight was in doubt. The second thing you don't know, if you go back to the 11th round, which Rancis won and boxed beautifully and actually was even being a little bit of a showman. There was a screw up in the corner. And between rounds 10 and 11, he was told by his corner, this is the last round, so let it all go. The guy's not his truth. And we're laughing about it today, but there was either a mistake in the round card or something, but whatever it is, Chico Rivas thought it was round 12, told it was round 12, let it go, this is three more minutes. And he shot his low. He told me, I shot him by low. He was all after that.
Now, how close, have you asked him, how close was he to hitting the canvas after that barrage?
I didn't ask him that question. And I don't think he actually got hurt in the barrage. I think he just was exhausted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting how hard those guys each hit each other, and nobody seemed wobbled. I mean, even after the headbutts, Usmani was tough enough to keep going.
He's a very rugged, game, tough fighter who does everything well, but nothing great.
Now, obviously,
when Rancis fights the way he's supposed to fight, he can be a great fighter. When he fights the way the opponent fights, he becomes ordinary like they are.
Yeah, I've definitely seen him at his best out in Vegas, and really. Priceless looks on his opponent's faces after ten shots at his full power. You can just see it in their face. They don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, and anybody that studies boxing knows that all of the power comes from the short shot. You know, it's like a golf swing or a baseball player. You know, it's that short contact area where you generate all your power. Plus, as a boxer, you know that you get hurt by the punches you don't see. When he starts getting long and looping and reaching and all that stuff, he's not going to knock anybody. I don't care how strong he is. But when he works behind the jab and digs to the body, you know, he can knock anybody out. So it's up to him. I mean, I guess he's got to take from it. He's a frustrating guy to promote because you see flashes of greatness, and then you see times where he's almost incompetent.
Now, obviously, we didn't on who won the fight, but you mentioned some other controversial decisions, and obviously, boxing is not—it's not really seeming to find any way to improve after some of these even worse decisions that we can both agree on. What would you say as a promoter that the sport should do to get better at that and not have these controversies?
It's a very difficult question. I'm not sold on the fact that judging is always bad or bad too often
or if there's controversial decisions. I have a different opinion of the judging of the sport than maybe a lot of people. I mean, yeah, I've disagreed with decisions many, many times. And I've seen things that shouldn't happen in the ring because a judge has a bad match. Like, look what happened to my fighter Carlos Molina against James Kirkland. But when you look at judging a boxing match, a 10-point must system, so 90% of the rounds or 95% of the rounds are 10-9 rounds, you can dominate a fight and lose a decision. And the other thing I have found interesting is I was judging a fight one time, not judging a fight. I was promoting a fight one time at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, and it was a very controversial decision. I don't know if you remember the decision. I had Juan Urango. He won the title by beating Ben Rabah, and he won a unanimous decision. But what I found fascinating was I knew 300 or 400 people in that arena. And depending on where they were sitting, depended on who they thought won the fight. And when you have three judges on three different sides of the ring, you're watching three different fights. And the television guy is watching the fourth fight. So there's four different perspectives of the same fight. And they don't always look the same.
Right.
And I really believe that's a big factor. And if you, I have found that if you start taking polls, you know, I've taken informal polls, people that I know at various events where there's a controversial fight. If you spoke to the fans sitting behind the judge that ruled one way controversially, they would agree with that judge. And you spoke to fans on the other side that were behind the other judge that ruled the other way, they would, more than likely than not, they would agree with that judge.
Right.
And when press row agrees with the television commentators, it's because they're all sitting on the same side of the ring.
Yeah, we actually brought that up with Steve last week. How sometimes you know, the judges are sitting there looking through the ropes, and you know, a rope can get in the way, a referee can step in the way, and that's not necessarily the best vantage point. And I was thinking about
I've seen fighters against the ropes. His back is to the official. The guy coming forward is doing most of the work and landing shots on the guy against the ropes. So the official who's watching this guy come forward, punishing the guy against the ropes, is going to probably give that round to the aggressor. Now the guy coming off the rope lands a beautiful uppercut and wobbles the guy in one of those round-changing punches. But the ref who's directly behind him, he doesn't see that shot. So
actually, a great example of that was at one of those Cosmopolitan cards. I forget what fight it was, but I was sitting right at ringside. I was lucky enough they set me up with a nice seat, and there was a low blow that got called, point taken away and everything. And between rounds, one of the photographers comes right up to me and he says, "Look at this shot I got." Sure enough, right on the belt. It was a perfectly legal punch, and you know, there was the evidence right there. So I was thinking over the last week, why not have like a closed-circuit TV system with no graphics that these guys can have a monitor where they can watch that kind of stuff with replays?
Yeah, but again, that skews it also because the monitor's only showing the fight from one angle.
Yeah,
I guess. I like the judging, and the reason I like the judging is because you get three different angles. And it doesn't make one judge right and the other two wrong when there's a different decision. They're watching three different fights, but they're watching it from all three of the four different angles. So it's not such a bad thing when they disagree. But hopefully they get it right over the long period of time. I mean that's the beauty of our sport. I mean, we'd have nothing to talk about if there wasn't arguments over decisions or who's going to win. It's a subjective scoring system.
It reminds me of a fight I went to about 10 years ago with the Philadelphia Spectrum. It was Bernard Hopkins was defending his title in the main event against a grossly overmatched opponent. The main event was atrocious. But the head undercard fight, it was on HBO, was a rematch between heavyweights David Tua and Haseem Rahman. David Tuttle full time. I believe I was there. It was at the was it at the Cox Pavilion in Las Vegas, or was this a different fight?
No, that was this fight was at the Philadelphia Spectrum.
Okay.
Which has since been torn down. The main event was Bernard Hopkins and Murad Hakkar.
Okay.
As soon as the bell rang, he actually started running away. But the chief undercard fight was David Tua and Haseem Rahman. They had fought before. Tua had landed a punch late for one round. It was like right after the bell, and Rahman.
Wasn't that one at the Miccosukee? The first one where Lou Duva ran in the ring, and it was all kinds of controversy.
Tua landed a punch right after the bell rang. And Rockman was out on his feet. He never recovered. Then,
yeah.
Well, this was a rematch. This was back in 2003, just 10 years ago. And we went there. It was me, my father. We're both big boxing guys. And then my neighbor went. Him and his brother-in-law really started to get into boxing. And a friend of mine from work came. And we always used to joke. Everything we would bet would always be a Twix bar. So we're sitting there, and we're like, let's bet on this fight. Okay, let's bet a Twix bar. And I got to it. He took Rock. And after 12 rounds were done, he turned to me, and everybody in the arena said Tua won that fight easy. So, you know, they announced a split draw. 116-112 Rockman, 116-112 Tua, 114-114. They announced it a draw. And we both looked at each other. We're like, you got to be kidding me. And people were walking out of the arena that night saying it was disgusting, it was terrible. No way Rockman won that fight. Well, the next day, I watched the rebroadcast on HBO, and the announcers that night, Jim Landley, Larry Merchant, I forget who the third announcer was. I forget if it was Manuel Stewart or Max Kellerman. But they were all sitting there saying, Rockman's winning this fight. Howard Letterman scored at 116-112 Rockman. And what didn't tell to the people viewing Mina was the fact that when you saw it up close on the cameras, when they were fighting in close and Tua was landing these big hooks, like one every 10, 20 seconds, you hear thud, thud. And that sounds through the arena, and people are going, oh shit, Tua's winning this fight. But between those 10 and 20 seconds, Rahman's landing these little short jabs on the inside. So he actually ended up punching two of them.
There's so many factors that influence judges and fans. I mean, if you were in the arena the other night and you didn't see the fight, but you looked at Bartholomew's face and you looked at Usmani's face, Usmani's all busted up. Bartholomew don't have a mark on him.
Yes.
Well, I think at least one of those cuts was on the headbutt, though.
Yeah, absolutely. But even under the eyes, in the first two rounds, he was getting before the head. His face was all red.
The first two rounds and the fourth were all Bartholomew. I think the third was kind of hard to call. But
okay. Yeah. All right. So assume you give the third round to Bartholomew. He's up 4-1.
Yeah.
When he went into his boxing mode in 10 or 11, he won those rounds.
Well, I'd say the 10th. I don't know about the 11th. I'm looking at.
I thought the 11th was the best round since the second. But
the punch net numbers.
I haven't seen it yet, so I can't comment on what it looks like other than sitting there live and being involved in the event. So it's difficult for me to. My recollection might be different, but when I see it again, I'm looking forward to seeing it again. I just haven't had the time.
Well,
if you read some of the media stuff, excuse me, I'm sorry.
It was almost like a repeat of the first two. I mean, he regained his confidence. He was back in that same head movement and hand slow style. But the 11th round, I got the punch stat numbers right here. He landed 22% of his punches, Bartholomew. He had 14 total punches landed out of 64. And Usmani had 24 total punches landed out of 89. So he had landed.
So 2 punches different.
Yeah. Well, 10 punches different.
10 punches. You know, you know, I listen, I was reading all the internet stuff, and people are saying, oh, it's corrupt, and Margulies is paying off officials down there, and it's, I've been in my share of robberies on the other side. I mean, I've been a victim as much as I've been the beneficiary of tough decisions.
People just automatically jump to that conclusion that it's got to be
of course.
But I think it's more along the lines of, you know, sometimes judges feel maybe like they're kind of obliged to go for the hometown guy, or maybe they're...
Not always. I'll tell you a story. Back in, as you know, I promoted Glenn Johnson through the latter part of his career. And when we went over to, I'll never forget this, we went over to England to fight Clint Woods for the third time. And we were at, the judges were Mickey Valen from England, a Mexican judge, and Rick Bays from Florida, who was one of the judges last night. This is why it's a funny story. So we're in England, and I made a deal to co-promote one who was at war with Dennis Hobson, who had just taken Ricky Hatton from Frank. So I teamed up with Frank to get a level playing field in England, fighting the hometown guy, Clinton Woods, who was promoted by Dennis Hobson. So Frank was my partner. So the three judges are, as I told you, Rick Bays, Mickey Mann, and some guy from Mexico. And it's a very close fight. I mean, very close fight. It could have been a draw, could have won either. Anyway, Glenn lost the split decision. But what's interesting about the split decision, the Mexican judge gave the fight to Clinton Woods. And the English judge, Mickey Van, gave the fight to Glenn Johnson. And Rick Bays from Miami, friend of Glenn Johnson's, socially, you know, over the years, gave the fight to Clinton Woods' vote that night. And I'm in the ring, and Frank Warren looks at me and says, I got my guy. I did my job. Like, I was supposed to convince Rick Bays. But the irony of that is, now, fast forward, we're 5 years later, 6 years later, and Rick Bays is one of the judges last night. And Henry Foster, when he got appointed, Henry Foster, who's the manager of Glenn Johnson and the manager of Ransom Bartholomew, was yelling at me, how could I let the idea, how could you have this guy and this and that? And to make matters even further interesting, as you know, Henry manages Lee Franco. And Franco had just fought a controversial decision in Argentina to Munoz. And so Henry was pissed off. He thought he won that fight and he got robbed in Argentina. Well, Argentina ruled for Munoz. So he was so mad at the judge's pal before the fight. I mean, he thought we were going to win and get robbed. So it just goes to show you never know. You just never know.
Well, what's that saying about boxing is the theater of the unexpected?
That's correct, you know, and we have these decisions that people do. You know, I just wish, I just wish that Teddy had been, I don't think there's a lot of people that watch the fight with an open mind that think, Usmani won 9-3. So I mean, I wish Teddy was a little bit more objective in trying to make case for a national commission and court judges. I mean, I wish Teddy was more even-handed and say, you know, it was a close fight. And the hometown guy got the edge, and maybe he shouldn't have, or maybe he should have.
Right.
You know?
Well, the thing was, I mean, you could definitely say without a doubt that I think Bartholomew won 1, 2, and 10. So those are the three rounds that Teddy was talking about.
You thought he won four also.
He won four according to the punch numbers too. But when I watched the fight, I didn't really notice that he won four because I thought it was a lot closer. I thought Usmani was starting to turn the corner in round three, and I thought he really continued that in round four. But looking at the punch stat numbers. It's only four more total punches landed for Bartholomew, but he landed 24% of his punches to Usmani's 16%. So
you know, punch stats can be also misleading because some guys are slappers or some guys are bangers. I mean, but at the end of the day, I saw and then I thought he got the fight, and I'm sitting there going, it's a very close fight. And then I was glad when he boxed 10, and in my opinion, he won 10 and 11. So, but again, I'm doing more than just watching the fight. I have people I'm entertaining. I was a promoter of the event, so yeah, I couldn't really focus on it like you guys probably did, you know. So, you know, well, I'm looking forward to watching the tape again. I haven't even heard Teddy's tirade. I just been told about it.
I thought he was going to go run over and yell at somebody that had to do with it.
He's done that before. So, I mean, but see, that's not good for the sport.
No.
That's not good for the sport. You know, I think our sport needs broadcasters that talk about what's great about the sport, what's bad about it. You can criticize to the sport.
Well, I think people like him though because he's very passionate about it. He knows from being a coach and being involved in the sport for so long, what it takes to get to that point as a fighter. And for a guy like Usmani with a record like that and to not even be known that well, to get to that point where he's got a title opportunity. And, you know, you watch a fight like that and you really think from your knowledge point and your vantage point that guy won the fight and he got it taken away from him. I mean, Steve Cunningham was talking about this last week. You know, he works so hard.
Oh, I know. I thought Steve beat Adam for sure. But again, you know, I understand.
The objective thing with the judges, they've also had a lot of experience with the sport, and they consider ring generalship to be the number one thing to judge around on, and you can broadly define.
Number one thing is ring generalship is certainly one of the four or five for criteria, but clean effective punching is the number one criteria.
All right. Well, I'll take your word for it.
Just ask Carol. Don't ask me.
But just getting past the whole controversy thing and just looking at the whole sport in general. What do you think it's going to take to get more people interested in it and more fans gravitating up?
Television networks forcing the best fighters to fight the best fighters. People want to see great fights. Listen, whatever people want to say about me or that event, nobody's going to criticize me for the matches that I made.
Right.
I put two undefeated guys in the ring in what probably was a pick-up fight, and no matter what the result was, no matter who you think won, I don't think anybody's going to tell me it wasn't a very, very good fight.
Oh yeah, it was a hell of a fight.
So that's what we need. We need great fights.
Yeah,
we need great fights.
I mean, I was very surprised. I mean, I thought that Bartholomew was going to be able to pass his test, but I thought it was a huge test for him after seeing some of the guys he fought out there in Vegas.
And that's the kind of fights fans need to see, whether it's on ESPN, Telefutura, HBO, or Showtime. What I don't like is some of the fighters that are getting passes because they're with strong promoters, strong managers, and they get away with fighting less than credible opposition.
Right.
I mean, who wants to see Broner beat another guy that shouldn't be in the ring with him, or Gary Russell, or, you know, who wants to see that? Nobody. That's not good for boxing. Cotto and Mayweather were good for boxing. Those fights are good for boxing. You know, to open up ESPN with a controversial fight like we just had, I think it's good for the sport.
Well, yeah, in a way, it gets people talking about it. But you get a lot of people that are on the fence. You know, they like me. I like MMA now more than boxing, and I box in college. And I kind of feel bad about it in some ways. I feel guilty about going away from boxing because I used to love it so much. But, you know, I went back and I watched boxing again in this instance. I sit down and I watched the whole Friday Night Fights card there, and I was probably not as disappointed as Denny, but I just, you know, I was like, after that 12th round, I said to myself, they can't take it away from this kid who's money. I just was very impressed with his comeback effort. And, you know,
so was I, and you know what? And you know what? The sport would be good to him, and he's gotten, and he had never fought on national television before, and he's gotten two national television offers since that fight. So he's not going to get hurt from losing that fight.
But
He has a higher stature coming out of that fight than he did going in.
Right, well, I'm thinking if I was just a fan and not involved in the sport, and you know, I have to go back to boxing, I have to keep watching it because it's my business. But if I was just a fan in that position, and I was leaning towards MMA, and then I went back to boxing, and that happened, I would probably want to stop watching boxing because.
I don't know. I think fans will complain and say it's bad, and I don't want to watch boxing, and they'll go back to watching it because of the controversy. There are a lot of people that like to complain in this world. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. You know, would you rather see a three-round schmear where a guy doesn't belong in the same ring?
No.
You see a great shit. You know what I mean? I mean, I could watch. And by the way, I told this to Doogie, who called me and said, you know, I'm going to make three. I said, I paid a lot of money in sanctioning fees to get Francis the opportunity to fight for number two. I'm not gonna give up that opportunity now to make a rematch and blow the position. Although I don't have a problem giving you a title opportunity, you know, if Francis wins a title or whatever becomes champion or something. But you know, he was like, well, you never win a title if you would make the rematch. I'm sure you could sell it to HBO, you know, this and that. And I go, believe me when I tell you, and I think you guys understand the politics and the market. If I could sell the rematch to HBO, the hell with number two. Would take the money and sell it to HBO. The neither guy's getting on HBO as the A side. So we're stuck. We're stuck in the position we're in.
What I read, though, you're still open to setting up a rematch eventually.
Of course.
I mean, that's the most important.
Well, why wouldn't I? It was a great fight. And if my guy fights the way he's supposed to, it was easy. And if he does what he does again, Rancis will play. He'll probably get knocked out. So why wouldn't I make the fight again? Even offering the options on this guy to make the rematch. So I'm not, why wouldn't I? There's no reason not to make the rematch, but there's no more money in the rematch than there was in the first fight because of the politics of boxing. If HBO said to me, we'll give you boxing after dark day, make the rematch. Here's $250,000. I'd make the rematch. We tried to make $10,000 for that fight.
In a lot of situations, like Manny Pacquiao, Bradley, Cunningham, Adamek, you know, Manny didn't want the rematch, and Steve doesn't want a rematch. No.
Well,
it's clear. And in this situation, I think it was close enough. There was differing enough opinion on it that I think both guys would be interested in a rematch.
Absolutely, and there's no resistance from. And they don't have a promoter. They don't have a promoter. He's a free agent.
But getting past all the controversy and the negativity, why don't you give us a rundown of some of your other fighters and what they're involved in these days and what's next?
Well, my next event is February 1st in Chicago on Friday Night Fights. I really think I have a terrific triple header. Mike Mowo, who's a local fighter, is fighting a young Polish kid I promote who's pretty exciting heavyweight by the name of Artur Szpilka. He only had 12 fights, but he's going back and beating Jamil McClain, 22-year-old, really fun fighter to watch. And the co-feature will be a fight between Antoine Smith, who's coming off with that big win over Cruz, and he's going to fight Jose Luis Castillo in his second comeback fight under our promotional banner. And then the main event is an IBF eliminator to appoint the mandatory for Bundridge between Corey Spinks and Carlos Molina. And Carlos hasn't fought in Chicago in years, so people are pretty excited about it. And hopefully if Carlos becomes a champion, people will stop avoiding him.
Yeah.
Because to me, I don't think there's a more talented guy at 154 pounds, but I don't think anybody at 154 wants to fight him.
Yeah, I really enjoy
unless they have to.
Watching Carlos out in Vegas, just a tremendous fighter, and really impressed me.
People don't understand, this is a guy with no amateur background. And he's had 25 professional fights, so he's still learning his trade in the ring. And he's got a record of 20-5 and 2 draws. And if you examine that record carefully, he was 8-4. And when he was 8-4, all his losses were split decision losses. And his first draw was against Chavez, which until Chavez lost to Martinez was the only blemish on his record. And then when Chavez and Molina fought the rematch, everybody in the arena thought Molina won again, but he got robbed in Mexico. So he fought, lost, and his first draw in his first 12 fights were against Chavez Jr. Now he wins 8 in a row, 9 in a row, and he has a draw with Lara. And I don't have to tell you how good Arizlandi Lara is. And then he destroys Cintron, and he's destroying Kirkland until he gets that terrible thing that happened to him in the 10th round. So at the end of the day, you're talking about kid that maybe as good as anybody at 154.
Right. I thought he won the fight with Lara. I was right there. Right where the judge.
All right. So I mean, there are people that will tell you, you know, he could easily be undefeated. And at 25, instead of 20 wins, 5 losses, 2 draws.
Now, what got involved in boxing in the first place?
Excuse me? What got me involved in boxing?
Right.
Back in 1991, I'm a trial lawyer, and I've been a trial lawyer for 32 years. I get a call to handle a civil contract matter from a lawyer friend of mine in Las Vegas, who later became the mayor, Oscar. He was a friend of my partner's, and the lawsuit involved a contract dispute between two of us about who to prove this over the rights of Jorge Luis Gonzalez. And I represented Jorge. I got him freed up from his contract. He stayed with Louis. And we formed Team Freedom Promotions, and that's how I got involved in boxing.
Cool. I actually have some legal experience myself. That's when I was out in Vegas. I had a huge case involving a company called Zions and the Fertitas out there.
Uh-huh.
I promoted this big story about the corruption going on behind there. Their company was run by a convicted felon, and the Fertitas were involved. There was a loan attached to it. Pretty big story, and they ended up suing me for $25 million. So I had to.
Who's suing you for? They're suing you for $25 million.
They were. It's in bankruptcy now, and they were giving up on it. But I've been representing.
Oh, that's terrible.
5 years on that case.
Wow. Well, I'm still a lawyer, and I own Warriors Boxing, but I also am general counsel to the Bell Entertainment. And I do some legal work and for Barry Shaw, and I also do all the boxing work for 50 Cent and Samson Lukovic. So I have a lot of clients in the business as a lawyer as well as being an independent promoter.
So what's up with 50 Cent? What's going on with his stable? Is he adding anybody, or is he setting up any fights lately?
I'm attorney client privilege, but there's a couple of contract buffers we have out to people that there may be an announcement in the next couple of weeks. A couple of guys signed with him, but he's taking it slow, and you know he's trying to put his best foot forward and do the best by the guys that he's got, and also cut into a market that's pretty much deck stacked against him because of Mayweather and Al and the issues that arose between them. You know, but
kind of came out of left field. That whole thing kind of came out of left field with him feuding.
Yeah, well, he thought he was going to be Mayweather's promoter, and he thought they were going to be partners, and that was under that. It was under those that guy that he made his initial investment, and you could kind of say he got stuck.
Yeah.
But he's one of these guys who's very, very smart. He's very successful, and he's going to be successful in boxing also. I think he's great for the sport, actually.
Yeah, I definitely. When I saw the last open workout that Mayweather had, where 50 was there, I definitely appreciated the fact that he was on the Ustream feed. He was actually going around to all the reporters around the ring and having them introduce themselves and stuff. And that's a little something that as an entertainer that he does that's different than most people in boxing would do. You know, they're just all focused on the fighters.
Yeah.
But it's nice every now and
then. He's a celebrity in his own right. I went out to Las Vegas to handle his licensing hearing. I'm a promoter out there, and more people wanted his picture than they wanted to ask him any questions.
Yeah.
I once tried a case in Los Angeles, and the client was Sugar Ray Leonard, and I'll never forget that the jury was more interested in Sugar Ray Leonard than they were in the facts of the case.
Yeah, celebrity has a lot of sway.
Definitely. Yeah, it sure does. Sure does. I love celebrity clients. They're fun to work with because it makes me look like a better lawyer than I am sometimes.
Well, what would you say you love most about the sport of boxing?
I love the events. I love what goes into making an event. Drop great, and I love the sport. I do. I love the sport. I go to the gym a lot. I watch guys train. I'm a junkie. To a certain extent. But I as a promoter, I love the challenge of making the event. You know, putting a deal together that works for everybody, you know, fighters, the matches, the television deal, the site deal. I mean, I enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you from watching your cards, you definitely do a good job of it.
Thank you.
Everybody is happy leaving the arena in most cases, unless they're rooting for the guy that doesn't get
I mean, locally, I've gotten calls and people tell me it's one of the best fight cards they've ever been at, and you know, all stuff. And I take a lot of pride in that. You know?
And I
don't protect my guys. I don't think anybody's ever could ever say that, you know, Margulies or Warriors, they don't fight nobody. They protect their guys. We take on all comers. We take on all opportunities. You know.
Yeah, and you know, getting that set up at the Cosmopolitan there, a brand new hotel on the Strip.
Yeah, I'm trying to go. Yeah, that was one of those three events, yeah.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun.
One was
yeah.
A little windy, but, man, if that was...
Oh, that second fight was a challenge. Yes, it was.
What a great venue. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Looking up at the big screen that could be seen.
Yeah. And also the Chelsea Ballroom is a great venue. The indoor fights we did were a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really classy. The setup with the booths and the couches and stuff.
Yeah. John's Island. We called it John's Island. John Unwin, who's the CEO of the company, we nicknamed that area John's Island.
Oh, nice.
Hopefully we'll be back. In the not too distant future, working out a couple things with that.
Cool.
We'll see.
Well, does anybody have any other questions on the call here? I know I've been hogging the time.
Tom?
I don't think I heard that. Was it a question or just a greeting?
I think Tony was saying his battery is dying. I didn't hear what Tom was trying to
say. Oh, okay.
Tom?
Hey, listen.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Well, I was just saying, man, my battery's dying, so we're about to clock out till next week, guys.
All right. Tom, anything else?
Okay, Leon, thank you so much for being on. This has really been an education.
No, listen, I really apologize for missing the 8:30 call. If you guys ever want to talk to me again, feel free. I mean, I really enjoy talking boxing. I enjoy talking boxing with people who care about it. So I really want to thank you guys.
That's it. And you really, you make people think. That I appreciate.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
Leon, I definitely think it's actually better that it worked out this way because we get to talk to you for a little longer. We probably would have only had you on for about.
Anytime you guys want to talk about something or want to ask me to reference something or whatever, feel free.
All right, great.
You know, well, all right.
Do you have any final thoughts or anybody to give a shout out to or anything like that before we go?
Just boxing fans, keep coming, you know, and give us a chance to continue to make to bring excitement into the ring and understand that it's an imperfect sport and there'll be imperfect decisions, but that's part of the whole lore and part of our history. And I guess we got to fight our way through it.
All right, well, cool. It's definitely been enlightening, and I look forward to seeing your upcoming cards and what you continue to do for the sports. Great, and more power to you.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye. Good night.
Okay. Okay, have a good night. Bye-bye.